I'm Derek Russell.
And I'm Brad Locke, and this is The Memo,
a gathering of all things Northeast Mississippi, brought to you by The Daily Journal and DJournal.com. Good morning and welcome back to another Memo podcast. This is Monday, August 31st. I'm Derek Russell. Brad Locke out this week, here with producer Chris Kiefer. Chris, how are you doing?
Doing well, Derek. How are you today?
Doing fine. It's a lovely 74 degrees at the newsroom. Currently overcast at the newsroom. I don't know. We have no windows. We don't know what it looks like out there. We stay in here where we record.
Inside the warehouse.
That's where we stick to. We've got a full show running up over the weekend. We'll talk about anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, some local law enforcement shootings that have been happening. Going to talk to William Moore, our crime and law enforcement reporter, about that. In addition to that, it's kind of a dismal show today. Between that and then we're going to talk to our education reporter Emma Crawford about the scare at Mississippi State University last Thursday. So, and then we'll round it out with Brad's law enforcement defense report. So,
who produced this show? What's going on?
That would be you. You picked all these.
You just doom and gloom Monday. We'll start the week.
You're not a happy guy today, are you? So we were actually going to bring in our editor, Rod Guajardo, to talk a little bit about the Katrina anniversary, but he was not able to make it today, or just bailed on us altogether. We're not really sure. But let's dive into that a little bit, and we can talk. The 10th anniversary was on Saturday, correct?
That's right, Saturday, and it's hard to believe. You know, I was listening to a lot of coverage. I grew up in New Orleans and was listening to a lot of coverage of the local New Orleans mega radio station, 870 AM, and you know, people were kind of saying a combination of both, that it feels like it was just yesterday and it feels like it was a lifetime ago. And it kind of rings in both ways.
It's amazing going back. I was watching some of CNN's coverage with Anderson Cooper and when they were there originally, and they were going back and filming in the same streets where they filmed 10 years ago, and they were matching up some of the footage. And I remember watching all of this stuff vividly, but it was just the sheer catastrophe of it, I didn't appreciate really, or have not appreciated since it was happening, until I went back and watched some of this nightmare play out all over again.
Yeah, it's the same, you know, on that. When it happened for me, I had just graduated from Ole Miss the spring before, May before it hit, had been home in New Orleans that summer, and had just left about 2 weeks earlier, started an internship in Birmingham. So I was, you know, just a couple weeks into my first job. And so, you know, you kind of get so focused on that job, and then Katrina hits, and there's just so much going on. And, you know, as time went, I just felt this survivor's guilt that, you know, here I was safe in Birmingham and had a job, and seeing the way it impacted, you know, so many people I care so much about in my hometown, that I couldn't watch enough coverage for a while. You know, there was a period as the anniversary would go 2, 3, 4, 5 years. I just wanted to relive it all and feel it all again, and just, again, felt this guilt that I wasn't there when it happened. And then this time, I wasn't sure if I could do it again. Like, I almost didn't watch it because it is, as you said, just kind of so visceral living it again. And then I just kind of decided I had to. But there were some moments on 870. They just replayed a lot of their broadcasts from 10 years ago, and there was a moment of just hearing people calling for help while they're trapped in their houses. And it really got to me. It's just something, such an emotional time.
Now, your parents evacuated, correct?
They did. They came up to Oxford. And that was kind of a scary thing too. I remember, you know, when a lot of people have said, you know, why didn't more people evacuate, or why weren't they have more plans to evacuate? But the thing with this storm is, I remember it hit on a Monday. And it was about Wednesday or Thursday. Deanna and I were dating at the time, but her parents were still living in Niceville, Florida, on the Florida panhandle. I called her dad that Thursday because the hurricane was headed that way. And it was a Saturday morning. I remember waking up, and that was when it was first coming to New Orleans. So really about 48 hours before it hit. And my parents had never evacuated for a hurricane before. You know, there's so many that had happened in the years before that you just hear stories about people evacuating and get stuck in traffic for 4 and 5 hours and then coming back and nothing happened, everything's safe and just a big ordeal. And so they had never done it. And I think the other thing that really made the severity of this stand out. And I remember my sister, who was still, you know, living at home at the time, telling it was when they woke her up on a Sunday morning and said, "We're leaving." I know her eyes got real big, because for my parents to evacuate, you know, that meant
big deal.
It was a big deal.
Yeah. So, and I've never actually asked you about any of this, so it's interesting to hear you talk about it. I mean, did they lose anything or?
No, we were really blessed. They're in Kenner, which is the western side of the city. The flooding in Kenner was just so much rain in such a short period of time. You know, quick flash flooding. And their house was okay on that. But where the worst of it was, where the levees broke, was in different parts of the city. And so, you know, they were really blessed and spared. But it also kind of plays into that. Mm-hmm. You just kind of see so many people hurt so much. And then you feel that, you know, that we were so fortunate. And just, you know, it makes you feel bad. Survivor's guilt, I guess, too, to a degree.
The sheer impact of the storm, I mean, to be able to feel it so far. I mean, I was in Starkville and 05. I was at Mississippi State, and I mean, I can remember how bad the weather was that day in Starkville, you know, coming that far north.
We got it in Birmingham, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, just I can remember the intense rain and storm, so I can't even begin to imagine, you know, obviously what, you know, even an hour or 2 hours further south would have been like, yeah. Much less, you know, in the eye of it.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I remember there was a video that my aunt had sent me, I guess a home video that some guy in Slidell had made that kind of went viral, and you can just kind of see how the water came up hour by hour, and it was just eerie to watch. Mm-hmm. And just hearing stories like, again, my parents had gone up, they'd gone up to Oxford first, spent a couple of weeks there, and then they came to Birmingham and spent a couple more weeks with me. It was maybe about 3 weeks or so before power out and everything else.
Yeah.
And so, you know, even though, you know, the house didn't have big damage, it was still, you know, everything was just shut down there for so long. But a couple of my best friends lived in Chalmette, which was one of the areas that was hardest
bad
hit.
Spot, yeah.
And, you know, when they came back, I mean, they had water all the way into their attics and about maybe 8 inches of oil, because an oil refinery had also leaked, and, you know, everything was just ruined. And one of my friends' dad worked for the hospital down there, so he had to stay. And his mom had evacuated to somewhere else in Louisiana, Bush, Louisiana. And cell phone coverage had gone out. I mean, even in Birmingham, my cell phone didn't work. And he couldn't get them for about 3 or 4 days and have any idea how his parents were doing. And his dad spent a night on the interstate overpass while they got him out by boat and waiting there, and just, you know, all those stories. It was amazing what happened in that storm.
What's the, I mean, mentality, I guess you're, I don't know if you're calm or panicky, but, you know, like you said, your parents went and woke your sister up and said, "We're leaving." I've always thought if my house was on fire, what one of those things is like, what's the one thing you go get? I mean, do you grab stuff? Do you take it with you? What, I mean, did they take anything with them running out of the house, getting in the car to get out of there? Or?
I don't remember well. I know, as I've been reading a lot of stories lately of the coverage, and, you know, we had a big package in the journal this weekend, including some people who've now moved to Oxford who used to live in New Orleans, and a lady who's now in Tupelo who used to live in New Orleans. And, you know, a lot of them talked about really just, again, had done the drill before from evacuating, and so you take 3 or 4 days of clothes. And I think it was maybe the lady from Oxford said that fortuitously someone at the last minute said, "Don't forget to take your insurance papers."
Yeah.
And you know, that kind of made all the difference.
As Chris did mention, of course, we did have a story about Lee County native now that escaped the storm. Refugees in Oxford that had... is refugee the right word?
Evacuee.
Evacuee, yeah. That's what
we got sensitive. I remember my sister getting in a big argument with my brother's roommates while they were there.
Yeah, evacuee.
Don't call me a refugee.
One story that our general assignment reporter, Zach Horsborn, did was discussing the impact locally with organizations that took part, the Red Cross, Bancorp South Arena, several different places.
Yeah, I know the Bancorp South Arena became a big shelter. You said you were in Starkville at the time. Do you remember much about what was going on in Tupelo? Or was there a lot going on in Starkville, too?
You know, my dad's the director of operations over there, and I remember talking to him I too remember the phones not working for a certain period of time. It wasn't nearly as long, obviously. I think they got it back up, but on the day of, at least, it was kind of bad. But I can remember talking with him and just saying, yeah, the place was just full. I mean, it was people everywhere. But obviously, Tupelo not nearly as bad as Starkville, which was not nearly as bad, obviously, as Meridian and then further down. Of course, getting into Louisiana, but so I don't have a whole lot of recollection, but I can remember discussing that with him of the impact that it had. Even that photo of Building 6 of the furniture market that we had in Saturday's paper
was Sunday. Yeah, Sunday's paper
was just amazing to see all those clothes laid out that had been collected.
It was something
that I donated.
Yeah, and the outpouring of help for people. I mean, you know, there's so many things that bring back goosebumps remembering it. Saturday was an emotional day remembering a lot of it, which is why I wasn't sure if I wanted to go through it all again.
Well, ultimately, 10 years is a good point to look back and remember the impact of something like that. So if you haven't gotten a hold of a copy of Sunday's paper, the journal, or definitely look online. We've got at least 5 stories, kind of our Katrina package for the weekend and the anniversary of the storm. Be sure to check that out. Now, like we said, we're not having the best. It's not a good news day here, but I guess if anything, what happened on Thursday did have a good outcome in Starkville. Emma Crawford here with us, our education reporter. How are you, Emma?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. We were recording the podcast Thursday morning when we got the call that there was an active shooter on Mississippi State campus. And I guess you and I are special to the newsroom in that we actually knew where everything was going down when they were saying yeah. buildings and stuff, because we're products of that university.
Yeah, I want to interject for a minute before we kind of get into your discussion of your story from Saturday. But we were just talking a minute ago, Derek and I were kind of reminiscing about Katrina and some of my memories from having grown up in New Orleans. But I figured that had to be a kind of emotional day for you Thursday, having just graduated from Mississippi State, knowing a lot of people there. What was kind of, how did you find out and what was it like for you?
Well, I'm still subscribed to the Marine Alerts. So I got one. You know, I guess right whenever they sent it out, and I kind of leaned over to William and I said, "Hey, William, this is going on. When, you know, if you want to make a call," I went in and told Rod, and then I was kind of like, "That's you know, that's really weird. Like that's where I went to school." Mm-hmm. And Derek, you probably thought the same thing, but mm-hmm. I mean, I had class in Carpenter Hall, which is where they said, you know, that he was, and I'm just thinking about my friends that are there, and just kind of weird. It's just weird because I love Mississippi State so much. Just weird to think, and of course it turned out fine and like nothing thankfully happened that hurt anyone, but I can't imagine if it had, it would have just been really hard to see or to hear about.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to find out pretty quickly that most of your friends there were okay, or did it take a while to get in touch with people?
Yeah, I have like a group of friends who still, we have like a text message group, and they were saying, oh, you know, I talked to so-and-so and he's here and they're fine and da-da-da. And my soon to be sister-in-law, she's a junior there. And so I texted her right away and I said, I hope you're not on campus, because she lived off campus, but she was in the library. And it turns out she got like, there were so many people running in and out of the library during that time that she got like trampled. I mean, like knocked over by all these people, crowds running in and out of the library. So she was like, I'm fine. I'm just, you know, a little beaten up. But I mean, you know, it was quickly, they were like, we're fine. We're just kind of freaked out because we don't know what's going on, because there was so much misinformation, as we saw here. I mean, all kinds of reports coming in and we didn't know what was true, and kind of
chaos.
That's a little freaky, but
yeah, chaos in the best sense of the term.
Yeah, definitely.
You
chaos.
Obviously you were editor at the Reflector, so you had some good contacts there that were helpful into figuring out what was true from what was
they were
untrue. I guess at the time
they were a big help, and so I'm glad that I was able to call over there and kind of get the scoop from them.
Well, as a result of this. Which, again, I think was the best possible outcome of all outcomes of what happened Thursday. Maroon Alert was a big thing when I was there, and I wish I could still be subscribed to it. I don't have a web ID anymore to have that, but
I'm kind of wondering when mine's going to expire. Yeah, I don't know how long I can keep it.
and you're going to be sad. I guess the closest thing you could do is add push notifications to Twitter and put it back on there, because they push it to Twitter at the same time they push it to everybody else. But Maroon Alert is the university's emergency management service, I guess, if you sign up for it, which I almost don't even understand having to sign up for it. It just seems like
it should be automatic.
If you have a phone, you should have that, because there's nobody that should have not received that message on Thursday as a result, in my opinion. But tell us a little bit about that system and other systems that are being brought to light.
Well, Maroon Alert is, I mean, you can get text messages. They also send out emails. And I don't know. I know some other places do they'll call you and it'll be like an automated message if you answer the phone. But I don't think Maroon Alert does that. Or if they do, I've never gotten one, or I don't know anything about it. So, but it's, you know, when there's an emergency on campus or there's a threat, and mostly like when I was in school, it was always if there was a tornado warning or if there was, you know, if they canceled class because of snow or something, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing, usually weather related.
I think, all the ones I ever got were just weather related.
Yeah. And so, but it's very useful, because I mean, that's the fastest way to get in touch mm-hmm. with people.
Oddly enough, I can remember getting one during Katrina. So there's tie that two together right there.
and I remember when I was a freshman, someone did get shot on campus in one of the dorm rooms. And it was like an isolated incident, like somebody from Jackson had come up and there was some sort of like altercation in this door. It was in Evans Hall, which they just tore down actually. But anyway, so this guy came up, shot the other guy, student died, that kind of thing. It was isolated, so it wasn't a huge threat to campus, I guess. But I mean, it was still kind of freaky. And I remember getting the Maroon Alert. I was off campus, but I got a text that said, you know, somebody, there's a shooter on campus, that kind of thing. So it's been very helpful, I would say, to just getting information out. And that's just their way of quickly letting everyone know when there's something that they need to know about.
Are there any other area universities or school districts that use any kind of emergency management?
Ole Miss has one, and it's called Reb Alert. So it's essentially the same thing. And something that was really cool about Ole Miss that I found out when I was doing interviews last week for this story was that they have like a video on their website, their like emergency, you know, alert website. And it's a video, and it actually is kind of like a tutorial of what to do in the event of an active shooter on campus. Mm-hmm. And so that was pretty cool, because it's very specific to that situation, but it's something that people can go and watch and get a good kind of visual and just more preparedness for that. If that were to ever happen, and hopefully that wouldn't happen, but
it's sad we have to have that video, but it's a good thing to have as a result.
Yeah. So they have that, and then, you know, it's very similar. And all of the systems are very similar: text messages, emails. Students sign up for them at the beginning of the year or any time during the year, but ICC has ICC alerts, and then Northeast Mississippi Community College has Tiger alerts. And they're all, you know, they go through the systems, and they only use them for emergencies, and that kind of, they're all similar.
One of the things I remember in touring state, like I said, 100 years ago, was, and this is not discrediting any other campuses, community college or otherwise, but I one of the big things that they drilled home was that the security, the police task force of the university was a full-fledged, mm-hmm. they were police. It wasn't, you know, security guards like you'll see at some universities and stuff across the nation, that they actually have a police task force.
And they actually have a canine unit now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
it really is a big deal. I've seen some reactions that have not been the best of way Thursday was handled, and I disagree. I think Thursday was handled beautifully.
I just don't think you can be cautious enough in that situation, you know?
I'd rather be panicky and safe
over-cautious
than not know anything and danger lurking. So I think Thursday was ultimately handled well.
A suspicious shooter could turn into an active shooter at any moment. So wouldn't you rather have everyone locked down and safe as if that was going to happen? You know, kind of assuming, you kind of have to assume the worst.
Yeah. I mean, I put myself in the position of being at the Union or something when that happened. And I would have rather run to a room and locked myself in than something happening across campus and me not know it. So I think it was handled in the best possible way.
One question I had, you know, Emmett, Derek was talking a minute ago about he'd be surprised anyone not signing up, but I got the impression from your story that maybe some of the schools are still trying to get more people to sign up. Has that been a challenge for some of these alert systems?
Yeah, and I guess the one that really, it was Northeast where they said, you know, we wish more students would sign up for this. And so I don't know. I guess I don't know why you wouldn't sign up for it. You know, in my head, I'm like, of course you're going to, of course you want to know when something's going on. And I mean, they all said, you know, it's not a thing where they're automatically put into the system to receive these messages. But I think this situation especially probably gave them that opportunity to say, like, hey, this is something you need to have. This is something you should really sign up for. And just to let them know again that that's a good thing to have. So, but yeah, I did get the impression that they wanted more people to sign up for it.
Emma Crawford, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, thank you to Emma. And, you know, we talked about Derek, you know, how fortunate we were that things didn't turn out worse on Thursday at Mississippi State. Unfortunately, that's not the only scary situation we've had recently. We've also had some incidents of local law enforcement officers getting shot, and then again, I guess the fortunate side there is that they've been okay, but it's got law enforcement more on edge, and we've got Daily Journal crime reporter William Moore here to tell us more about just state of mind of the officers and how that's changing their response. How are you doing today, William?
I'm doing pretty good.
Tell us a little bit about kind of what's been going on, some of the incidents that we've had, and how law enforcement's responding to it.
How many have we had lately?
Well, here in the past roughly 2 weeks, we've had an officer shot in Corinth and then had a deputy shot in Monroe County. Y'all both were wearing vests, bulletproof vests, both survived with relatively minor injuries, all things considered. But, you know, it does have law enforcement around the area on edge. While officially nobody has changed any kind of protocol, the way they respond, just the individual officers are being encouraged to be safer, to be more aware of their surroundings. So because of that, you know, the general public is probably going to see some changes. You know, if you get pulled over, especially if you get pulled over at night, you know, it might just be for, you know, an expired tag or a brake light out. You know, the officers, when they approach people, they're going to be a little more cautious. You know, they might come up a little slower. They might wait for backup. They're trying to just be more cautious. So they're going to err on the side of safety, you know, both for the citizen's safety and for the officer's safety.
I always was told there was guidelines to abide when being pulled over. That when the officer approaches your car, you wait to go for your glove box or your center console until you're told so. You don't reach before that, you know, keep hands on the steering wheel, that kind of thing.
Well, that's true of, you know, and especially with considering, I mean, all the different shootings. I mean, not just here, but the other night there was an officer shot in Texas just at a gas station. There was one shot outside of Lafayette, Louisiana, shot and killed going to a domestic violence call. Yeah. So, I mean, but on that line, when you are getting pulled over, you know, it's best to, you know, keep your hands on the wheels, whether in plain view, as the officer is approaching, don't be leaning over, rooting around, looking for your wallet or your proof of insurance. You know, wait for the officer to get there. Let him see your hands. Let him see what's going on inside the car so that he feels safer. And once he feels safe, things will go a lot smoother.
It's shared responsibility on both sides of the story.
Obviously, when you go into law enforcement, you understand that there are risks inherent with the job. But I would imagine, just as there was, a year and a half ago after the death of Officer Stauffer and the injury to Officer Mayer, when you've got so many incidents happening so far in a row, is your impression that it weighs more on the minds of officers, that it makes them a little bit, it's a little bit heavier, it makes them a little bit maybe more nervous, or?
Actually, it does. I mean, I've talked to, several veteran officers who have said the atmosphere today that they probably would not go into law enforcement just because the added danger involved with just folks out there willing to attack officers and without provocation.
The two officers who were shot recently were both, I guess, would it be fair to say they were saved by the bulletproof vests that they were wearing?
Definitely, yes.
Is that protocol for everyone, or will this kind of lead to greater awareness and more people, more bulletproof vests being worn?
There are federal grants out there right now which most agencies use to purchase bulletproof vests, and pretty much all the agencies around here throughout Northeast Mississippi, even small agencies, do have bulletproof vests, one for every officer. So, they're out there. They are available. Not every department has a policy where the officer has to wear the vest. Some officers choose not to just because, living in the South, this time of year, it's hot and it's humid outside. And, a bulletproof vest, while it's designed to, stop a bullet, it's heavy and it's hot. And I talked to somebody the other day that mentioned, that during the winter, it's no problem getting folks to wear a vest because it's an extra layer of insulation. Mm-hmm. But during the summer, some officers might decide, all right, well, it's just a little warm. I'll take my chances. But then on the other side, with the added incidents recently of folks getting shot, it's more of a incentive to wear the vest just when you realize what could happen out there.
And in the light of how hot it has been recently, I guess it's a good thing that both of these guys were wearing theirs as a result.
Yeah, well, one other thing, because both of those happened early in the morning. I mean, the one in Monroe County was a traffic stop about 3 o'clock in the morning. The officer in Corinth was about 4:30 in the morning. So, in the middle of the night, it's not going to be as hot. But in the cover of darkness, you never know what's going on. So that's one of the reasons why they were wearing their vests for certain.
Now, unfortunately, neither of these individuals have been caught, have they?
Right. Neither one of the shooters has been. There have been no suspects identified yet, and no one's been arrested.
And a large sum of cash available for information leading to the arrest.
Both the Corinth incident, it's about $15,000 reward right at the moment. And
wow.
The one in Monroe County is rapidly approaching $10,000 just for information.
William, do they have any theories on either motives for these shooters or reasons why this seems to be happening more often than it used to in the past?
They don't have any concrete evidence, but there have been some reports or suggestions that it could be tied to gang activity.
And another question, too. Your story talked about, it seems like one of the challenges may be if this makes officers more likely to call for backup when you're in a rural county where there aren't as much backup readily available. Does that present a challenge going forward?
For smaller agencies, it's a real challenge. There's some rural counties that might only have one or two deputies on duty at night. And, calling for backup, if you only got one other deputy, he could be on the other side of the county, and it might take 30, 40 minutes for him to get there. So that's why some small agencies have, they'll call the local city officers to try to get help, or they'll call the highway patrol when available.
Well, thank you very much, William. It's an important subject, and hopefully that everyone continues to be safe going forward. Well, Derek, it's been kind of a depressing show today, hasn't it?
Let's try to end on an upswing, even though these are still police reports we're going to be going over.
You know what? We'll stay on crime. But, yeah, maybe it'll be a, what is it Brad likes to say? It's comedy. It's tragedy if it happens to me. It's comedy if it happens to you.
If it happens to you, yeah. So with Brad out this week, we just thought we'd cover some of the best of the end of last week and the beginning of this.
And these all come from Brad's blog, tipsheet.djournal.com.
Seen one here. A man from the Christ the King Lutheran Church on Lawndale Drive reported a 2x6 sign advertising beer and Bible study event scheduled for September 10th had been stolen. The sign had been stolen. The man said the church had received some negative comments regarding the sign. He reported the sign was at the church around 10:30 a.m. on August 24th and was missing by 12:15 p.m. on the same date.
That makes me wonder one of two possible scenarios, and I'll have you weigh in on it.
Go right ahead.
Do you think he took the sign because he was offended that you had beer and Bible study together and he didn't think that those two should mix and he took it away? Or do you think he took it because he wanted all the beer for himself and he didn't want anybody else to know about it?
I figured he just wanted the sign in his yard. It seemed like a winner.
But now he has to host a Bible study and supply the beer.
It's fine. Come on over. A Church Street woman reported her kayak stolen from her friend's resident on Magazine Street. The woman stated she became aware it had been stolen after seeing a Facebook post of her kayak on top of a Toyota bearing a certain license plate tag. At approximately 5 p.m., the woman believes the car was headed to Buffalo River. She stated a paddle and skirt were taken as well. Brad weighs in that a police kayak chase would be pretty fun to watch as a result. Several good ones. There's one from today, which from Friday, actually, that I don't know that is a good one as a result of the context, but it sounded interesting that this is the Hunger Games one. Where did it go? A Guntown woman said she was outside talking on the phone, outside her residence, we don't know, talking on the phone when a man hollered at her. She turned to look and saw a man pointing a rifle towards her. And she said it had been an ongoing problem with the man hunting year-round on the property and making threats. And Brad asked if he was hunting her, if this was a Hunger Games-type twist.
Was he hollering at her because she was in his way?
I didn't really. The problem with these event reports, and I can tell you from collecting them for the short period of time that I was in charge of getting them on Mondays, there's always a sentence that's just not there that you really need to complete the story. That the officer just leaves out, and maybe it's because he doesn't know, or maybe he didn't think it's pertinent information to the offense. However, I, as the reader, really won't need that extra sentence to put this whole piece together.
I think it's educational. They want you to draw your own imagination and fill in the blank yourself.
Well, I do, trust me. There were several times that I was having to come up with my own instances of what happened. Weed eater stolen, that sort of thing. A cotton gin lane man reported someone drove through his yard leaving ruts. Other yards also were damaged by what witnesses said was a white Ford pickup. There were several empty beer cans left on the front man's porch. If you left full beer cans, though, he might be okay with it.
Took the words out of my mouth.
Yeah, apparently. There have been a string of auto thefts in the area over here lately.
Lock your cars.
So definitely, if you're not in a garage or carport, keep your cars locked when they're outside. Seems to be happening a lot. A woman on Danny Street reported that she had left her car unlocked overnight and left her purse in it, which is always a bad combination. But they did find the purse behind her house. The $1.50 in cash that she had in it was taken. But thankfully, nothing major to report. Just your usual string of bad days, I guess. But that brings us to the end of yet another Memo podcast for this Monday, August 31st. Thank you for joining us on a not so happy ride, but we hope we brought you some interesting news today that'll make you think. And we'll be back on Wednesday with a brand new episode. No Brad, as he is out for the week.
And it should be, her schedule permitting, Lauren Wood, Daily Journal photographer, will be filling in for Brad Wednesday.
Will be joining us on Wednesday, so we look forward to that. You can follow Chris Kiefer on the Twitter, at Chris Kiefer, myself, at W. Derek Russell on the Twitter. Of course, the memo, at DJournal Memo, and at DJournal Now on Twitter. Also, our home on the internet is djournal.com. Hey, remember to go to iTunes, leave us a review, leave us a rating, get us bumped up there so we can continue to bring you these each week. And we will see you next time. Thank you.